Welcome, everybody. This week's Parsha is Parsha's Behar, toward the end of the book of Vayikra, and it deals with the topic of Shemitah and Yovel, the seventh sabbatical year, and then the Yovel, the 50th year. This year, right now, in Israel, is a Shemitah year. The Jews are observing Shemitah now as we speak until Rosh Hashanah coming up. So if you go to Israel, you can experience that directly. So what we're going to talk about is the title of the class is A Home for Every Jew. So I want to start with a video. As they say, let us go to the videotape, which deal with something which is relevant to this thing. So I'm just going to back it up. Every year, the Orthodox Union has a community fair. What is the community fair? Where smaller communities outside New York have opportunity to share what they have to offer. So, and of course, what the obvious point is that it's, here we go. I'm going to go to the share screen and the video. Let's self-explanatory. Here we go.
Kind. This unique program offers information and resources to families and individuals wishing to improve their quality of life by relocating to affordable Jewish communities that offer professional opportunities all in one place.
The Orthodox Union's Job and Relocation Community Fair is an opportunity for people to learn about communities that they never knew about before and to see that there are opportunities for great Jewish life outside of New York.
When you move to a community like this, you really make a difference. You have a chance to have an impact not only on a smaller community, but an impact on the greater Jewish community.
This year, the 5th Jewish Communities Fair will be held on Sunday, April 26th, 2015.
All right, it's a little old.
Promises to be the largest ever in both community participation and attendance. Attendees will meet with representatives from local schools and synagogues, realtors, community leaders, even potential employers, all here with the exclusive purpose of presenting their city or town.
We look for communities to participate in this fair that have all the amenities that a person looking for somewhere to go would want. There's an Eruv, there's a mikvah, there's kosher food available, but most importantly, that there are jobs.
They'll introduce resources and programs available to those looking to relocate to growing and thriving Jewish communities outside the New York metropolitan area in both the United States and Israel.
Life in New York and some of the major suburbs of New York is very expensive, and there's an opportunity to have a beautiful home, day school of tuition at an affordable rate, and an opportunity for your family to really grow and prosper.
God, I very much appreciate the Orthodox Union for putting together such a terrific program, with having so many wonderful communities represented by so many terrific people, and it's a great service to everybody.
I've had a very enjoyable time since I got here about a couple hours ago. I've met a lot of communities. This is a very interesting event. First I've ever been to something where I could actually get to know people from other places, and not just from where I live in Brooklyn.
What it'll do for your wife, what it'll do for your children, your husband. Come and join us. See the experience. See what these communities have to offer. What an opportunity.
All right. Let us... Okay. So it's an old video, but it gets the main point across. So what problem with buying a home in a modern Orthodox New York community is this community fair solving?
The expense of it.
Okay. What are the chief expenses of living in the New York, New Jersey Orthodox world? Harlan, come on, man.
I feel like it's definitely housing, just because it's so much more I feel like if you look in other parts of the country, homes for $250,000, $500,000 versus here, there's really not much for under $1 million, especially not houses.
Correct. Harlan identified the number one problem is the cost of housing. More so than the cost of tuition, more so than the cost of kosher food, and kosher life. Let me break it down. Now, which gets to question number two, why do many people and families need to rent versus buy their homes in large Jewish communities throughout the world? Because they can't afford it. But they want all the amenities. So the obvious way is to just to rent. Let me just give you a couple of examples. And I'll get to why that is for a moment. So my parents made Aliyah 20 years ago. They live in Jerusalem. They live in Katamon, which is a nice community in Jerusalem. Any apartment, we're not talking about a house. Forget about houses. Apartment, the apartment that they currently are renting, would cost $1.5 million. Yeah. And it's not an amazing apartment, you know.
I've been there. It's nice, but I was surprised by the number.
You're not saying $1.5 million, right?
Right.
Now, can you anybody figure out why do house, if you want to buy an apartment, a four bedroom apartment in Jerusalem, why you're looking, as Harlan points out, north of $1 million? We're not talking about Teaneck. You can get a house for $1 million. Here, we're talking about an apartment. I'm not talking about a house. A house is $5-7 million. They don't even call them houses. They call them villas. Okay, why is that?
Location, right?
Break it down. Well, break it down. We'll be more specific. It's true. Harlan?
I feel like it's like more like just like there's only so much Jerusalem real estate and like so many people want to live there versus other parts of Israel, similar to here. Like, even though New York's so big, like the Upper West Side only has so many buildings. They can only put up more so fast. That's my, if I put on my economist hat,
it's basically rule one of economics, supply and demand. And the bottom line is, what happens is you get into the vicious cycle in the Orthodox world. Orthodox Jews have to be able to walk to shul on Shabbos. That limits, the house has to be on average under a mile to the shul. All right, you want to walk longer? It'll be cheaper. But most people at the weekend, they're tired, they're exhausted, they want to go to shul, they want to roll into shul, okay? One of the best features of my house is I am four houses away from a shul. Four houses away from shul. So that is a nice, that's a nice convenience, okay? So I'm in West Hempstead. The price of housing since I got it, my house value has nearly doubled since 2012. So in 10 years, 100% doubling. Now, it's not helping me anything because let's say I wanted to live next to Harlan in Teaneck and be with my two sisters, I would just sell one overpriced house and roll it into yet another house in Teaneck. I won't get anywhere, you know? So here's the deal. So therefore, all the Orthodox Jews have to live next to the shuls. So what does that cause? It becomes its own supply-demand curve against itself. So the more popular a community becomes, the housing goes through the roof. West Hempstead has recently, in the last 5 to 7 years, has been very nice community. It is a nice community and used to be identified as an affordable bedroom community in near New York. And now the prices are on the same par of many communities in the five towns, which was always viewed as far more expensive. Okay. Teaneck once upon a time was viewed as an inexpensive option. That is but a distant memory. Okay. So now Teaneck actually has a good value. One of the good things why Teaneck is so successful, they have a wide range of, they have apartments, they have starter houses, and they got mega mansions, so they got a lot of options. So that's the deal. So this puts a huge stress on top of what's the number two challenge, which just makes housing more difficult. When you have children, the mark of an Orthodox Jew is you send your child to a day school. What's the what is the intrinsic problem? In the regular world, what I mean, what is really day school? Let me just translate into it's private school. If you're an American, you pay property taxes, you're in a good district, you get yourself into a good public school, great. The only problem is that if you want yourself to be Jewishly educated and Jewishly connected, you want to send your kid to a day school. Well, now you're basically, you could be a middle-class guy really paying for something which in America is viewed as a upper middle-class thing. Most people will only, you know, pay for university when they go to college. Now the modern Orthodox and Orthodox Jew is doing private school education from kindergarten through 12th grade, oftentimes a year in Israel, and even and then they go, then they deal with college. So that puts a lot, that's another pressure point. So for these reasons, there's a tremendous motivation to leave the most popular, like where Harlan is, there are 50 kosher restaurants within 4 miles of his house. Probably 50, maybe 20. Probably 50, 35 to 50.
We mostly just go to the bar to Izzy's though, so I'm not sure about anything else.
Right. So, all right. So, you have your favorite, but there are lots of options in the Teaneck, Englewood area. I'm as Hempstead, we got plenty of options. And of course you live in the five towns. There are 60 kosher eateries. I understand 50 to 60 kosher eateries, including, and then, oh, you're in the Upper West Side. I keep on thinking you went, why do I think you were in Teaneck? Why do I think that? I don't know why. All right. I haven't met. Okay. But everything I just said that applies to Teaneck applies even more in the Upper West Side, which basically this is what happens to the Upper West Side. Who lives in the Upper West Side? Singles, oftentimes with roommates, crush into a very small apartment. Young couples with a child, or maybe two. And then at that point, they got to go, you know, when you go into a second bedroom, you're talking about a mortgage-sized payment. And unless you are absolutely committed to the city life, you got to check out, or you're a millionaire. One of those two options. Okay? So, or you inherited a rent control house from 1902 for apartment. Okay. Unless those things are true, you're bouncing from the city. It's just not affordable. And then you add everything in the city is more expensive. Welcome to the world of the $5 apple. Okay. And then not only that, the day schools, Manhattan Day School, Ramaz, they're more expensive because you're paying the Manhattan premium. So you got to be committed to paying the Manhattan premium. Now, of course, you get the benefit is you're in Manhattan, okay? But most people in the MG, lifestyle, they as they move on to the next stage of life, they move to the suburbs because it just is not a viable option. Okay, so I want to get to now. I want to ask now, going back to Israel and the city. How do real estate corporations, second home and investment home buyers contribute to the prices of homes becoming so high? Speak to that. Who can speak to that intelligently?
I will.
Yes.
I hope. The problem is that there are outside factors that make the neighborhoods that Orthodox Jews want to live in desirable. And so they attract a lot of investment property owners that are not necessarily living there, or they're not getting the benefit that the Orthodox Jews that are living there, like that need to be there, are getting. So it's driving the supply down.
Drive supply down and the price way up. There mm-hmm. are buildings there in Israel. Jerusalem is notorious for this. Just for those of you guys may or may not know, somewhat true in Manhattan, but very true in Jerusalem, in the quote unquote nicer communities, or let's say neighborhoods, you could have apartment buildings which are for most of the year half empty. the wealthy foreign owner, whether they live in France or New York or LA or London, will come in for the Chagim. They'll be there for Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot. They'll be there for that, for the Tishrei holidays. They might come in there for a weekend or two where it works for them. And of course, they'll be there for Pesach. But meanwhile, so people who are living in these apartments actually live in these sort of like, it's very actually awkward because you don't have neighbors. You're like keeping the lights on. You have this gorgeous apartment building, which is basically, you know, thinly used. So you lose that sense of community, but therefore that caused a trickle down effect that makes again, certainly Jerusalem and New York and other communities, the price, in addition to the Orthodox, I don't want to walk away from shul tax, you have the people buying up the housing, so there's even less supply, price goes up. Okay, with that, here's a scenario number one. Joe Mgier, who works remotely, is attending the OU Community Fair, which I showed you. They do it yearly. What are the top three must-haves he should look for in a community? So what do you think Joe should look for in a Jewish community?
The right synagogue.
The right synagogue, okay.
In a second, Scott's point, like, I feel like the synagogue is, like, kind of key. If there's not really a synagogue you can go, like, I know a lot of Judaism happens in the home, but, like, if you don't have a synagogue, it's, like, really tough.
Yes, but what kind of synagogue?
Right. I was going to say, like, a synagogue that has, like, good, like, groups for kids and like is affiliated with a day school that you like and like is like has a thriving community to exactly. Some definition.
At number one, you gotta like the rabbi. You got because he will play a role as an educator with the family. That's very important. A. B, what's the vibe of the community? Do you feel that there's a place for you there? Does it have the amenities? Now, so if you're in the Upper West Side, you have a shul in every corner. So you're paying, but you could only really go to one shul or maybe two. Or in Teaneck, so I'm in West Hempstead. We're up to now 7 or 8 shuls. So in the 5 towns, there's literally a shul also in every corner, obviously Jerusalem as well. So you're paying for the premium of having a multitude of Amazon-like choices, but you really can only use, you know, one shul at a time, and you want to develop. You don't want to be a shul hopper. You want to have a relationship. You want to connect your family to that. So number one is a shul. What's number two? What's your number two? We got shul.
I'm going to rule out kosher food because I feel like there's so much kosher food like in every supermarket. Unless you're a big meat eater, like I feel like that wouldn't be number two because you could
get it. Okay, so fine. So you're not putting kosher food as number two, but what's number two?
Maybe like friends or family.
Yeah.
Okay, friends or family. Okay. What else? But again, the assumption that Joe, who I'm going to add more facts, let's say he's currently living in the Upper West Side, he can't afford it, or he wants to, you know, move on. You know what I'm saying? What other points? So he may have to make some new friends. You know what I mean? And also, you know, you could FaceTime friends, you can call friends, you could Zoom friends. They could visit you. You could visit them. I mean, but if you're talking about a community for your family. Now, some people, that's super important. They like to live with their family all the time.
A commutable distance from work, if you have to go in.
Okay, close to work, you know. What else? But you know, this guy, I cut that part out because he works remotely.
Oh.
Just because that, otherwise, because I can, in a certain sense, yes. What other things, what other elements?
Yeah, I feel like job would have been like one or two pre-COVID, but that definitely is like no longer top three, given I feel like there's so much remote work now.
Correct. Yeah. I'm just trying to distill it.
Yeah. And like the elephant in the room is like the cost of housing. Like obviously like that has to be like more affordable than what you're doing now, or like doable compared to your other options?
Yes. Affordable housing.
I feel like Joe too probably wants to like buy a home just because with rent, like we had a big rent increase. I know a lot of other people in the city. And if you like own, especially when you have a family, you want to like have like
more, you wanna have roots.
Yeah. Reduce uncertainty too and how much you're going to have to spend each year. So.
Okay. So anything else? So we he's remote, so we don't have a commute problem. He's always on. He can always be on time for work. No, there's no rush hour on his way to his office in his house or apartment. So we have a synagogue. Kosher food is not there. Friends is up there. Friends, family depends on that. What else? What other items? What else do we put on the old list?
I feel like day school options or like something that's either there's like a close by option or like there's a community that you live nearby that is like also going to that same school.
So quality day school education available. Now, again, if you live in the, if you live in the Upper West Side, you live in West Hampton, you live in Teaneck, you have 25 options. So again, you're living there, you're paying for that premium. The fact is that you have a plethora, you have the most options anywhere because there are people who are in the city who go to school in the city or who go to school in New Jersey. There's all kinds of, there's a wealth of choices. What other elements? I guess also maybe people want to say, and then there could be other subject. Well, here's the thing. I'm going to show you a video that a community produced to present at a community fair. And let's do the reverse. Let's see how they're speaking to their customer and let's pull out what they're selling. Okay. I picked one. There's like 50 of them. All right, whatever. Let's go to the videotape.
If we only had day schools, Dayenu.
If we only had more jobs in the field of medicine, insurance, and government, Dayenu.
If we only had a couple of Orthodox synagogues, Dayenu.
If we only had affordable housing.
If we only had ice skating and ski slopes nearby, Dayenu.
If we only had more kosher food, caterers and grocery stores and bakeries, Dayenu.
If only we had a Broadway-quality theater, world-class art and science museums, cultural and historic venues, Dayenu.
Come see why we love West Hartford.
We love the Hebrew High School of New England.
The Rose Garden at Elizabeth Park.
Come see why we love West Hartford.
We love kosher food.
UConn Huskies.
The Judaica Stove.
Come see why we love West Hartford.
I love the JCC.
The Mark Twain House.
The primary reason why I came to West Hartford is because they had Jewish day schools, and we have been so pleasantly surprised coming from New York City.
I myself grew up here. It's a phenomenal place to come back, to be able to lead the school into the next generation of 21st century learning. The school is a place for personal and communal growth, for the observance of Torah, and for the enrichment of Jewish life for the next generation.
The schools are amazing. They're small, they're intimate. The cost of living here is incredibly good, so you can afford to send your children to private schools. You can afford to send your children to amazing camps. I truly thought I was going to fall off the face of the earth when I came here, but I really found it to be home. and we love West Hartford.
West Hartford is a warm and welcoming community. We've absolutely loved raising our children here.
I feel extremely privileged that I've been given this opportunity to move from what is a great community in the UK to an even greater community here in West Hartford.
And we invite you to come visit our community and think about it as the place where you might want to raise your family.
All right, so a little cheesy on the old cheesy on the video, but what were they selling? They're selling
a lifestyle. They're selling a lifestyle.
And what's that lifestyle? What are the features?
A Jewish kosher, Shomer Shabbos, Shomer Kashrut lifestyle.
But that's true for 70 communities in America. What was their little niche? What was their basically unspoken pitch?
I didn't catch it, but a wholesome family lifestyle, happiness, as opposed to tasting the buck.
Right. We're warm. We're small. We're intimate. You're not going to lose. You're only two, you're between, you're right between New York and Boston. And we got the kosher food. We got a number of synagogues to choose from. Not 100, but not only one. So you got, like a choice of four. They have a number of kosher restaurants. Not 100, but not just only one. They start off strong with jobs, and they, of course, were selling that, hey, we got affordable housing, and then you'll have all that extra cash to go to day school and amazing camps. So they were selling the dream of you can have a wonderful modern Orthodox life at the low price. Call today, do not delay. Operators are standing by. So they were selling that strong. Now it's a couple of years old, but if you the more recent videos, they're all the same. Because right now, does anybody know what the number one state in the union, which is receiving the most amount of influx of Orthodox families?
Florida.
Florida's correct. Texas.
Oh. And then Texas number two.
Really?
Yeah. Florida is exploding, and that's for two reasons. Number one, no state income tax. So New York State could be up to 6% of your salary could go to the state of New York. You will not have that in Florida. Many Orthodox
property taxes are so much lower in Florida.
And that's we're getting number one. And number two, property taxes are way lower. And the cost of living is way lower for the time being. But again, of course, now you want to go to Hollywood, you want to go to Boca, you want to go to all these communities. The prices have also jacked up because, 500 families from New York decided to come on down. So, and some people be able to work remotely, it's, not a big deal. And again, you need to get to New York. You get on a flight 2.5 hours later, you're in New York. Boom. And also I think there's a political element as well. You may or may not know, but Orthodox Jews tend to politically affiliate a little more on the Republican side than the Democratic side. So they're liking more DeSantis than Kathy Hochul. So they're liking more red or purple than blue. But I think that's not as much of the issue of the cost of living is less. And that's what's going on. But that's going to soon fill up. That's already if that was a sweet bargain, that bargain's already off the table. Other communities are starting to roll into because, again, to live in New York is just very, very expensive. And that's the whole thing. So I'm doing this not just to talk about, the important topic of Jewish housing. What does it got to do with the Parsha? So we're going to find out. We're going to get to it. All right, let's get to the videotape. Not the video, but we're going to get to the... Okay. All right, so... Okay, so let's take a look. All right, Harlan, can you do some reading?
All right. The sabbatical year. God spoke to Moses at Mount Sinai, telling him to speak to the Israelites and say to them, when you come to the land that I'm giving you, the land must be given a rest period, a Sabbath to God. For 6 years, you may plant your fields, prune your vineyards, and harvest your crops. But the seventh year is a Sabbath of Sabbaths for the land. It is God's Sabbath during which you may not plant your fields nor prune your vineyards. Do not harvest crops that grow on their own, and do not gather grapes on your unpruned vines, since it is a year of rest for the land. What grows while the land is resting may be eaten by you, by your male and female slaves, and by the employees and resident hands who live with you. All the crops shall also be eaten by the domestic and wild animals that are in your land.
Okay, so here's the... So what is Shemitah? This is called Shemitah, the sabbatical year. What are the basic... What is Shemitah?
It's like a year without without receiving any benefit from the land. Like,
well, are you allowed to go into your olive grove, into your orange grove, and pick oranges?
According to like 5, it seems like no, but according to 6, it seems like yes.
Right. So there's two kinds of gathering. There's gathering for commercial, for like gathering your produce to sell. That's forbidden. Personal consumption, that's permitted. And basically, in one word, what is Shemitah? It's a Shabbos of the land. So you can't work the land as a tool of gaining profit, and you have to just, you're allowed to eat, you know, the food of the land. It has what they call the Kedushat Shvi'it, the holiness of the seventh year. And everybody, but you have no ownership, because anybody is allowed to walk into that field and take it, because for the seventh year, it is you cannot assert any personal ownership, okay? Who can eat of the fruits and vegetables that are growing naturally in your fields and in your orchards?
Anyone passing by?
Anybody, you, your slaves, your employees, even the animals. That's it. You can't assert any control during the Shemitah of the crops, okay? And you can't prune it to maximize it. Now, there are certain rules that you're allowed to, you know, water so it won't die, so to prevent it from just being destroyed, you can. But to maximize return, you can't, okay? Let's keep on going. Harlan, you're doing a great job.
All right. You shall count 7 sabbatical years. That is 7 times 7 years. The period of the 7 sabbatical cycle shall thus be 49 years. Then on the 10th day of the 7th month, you shall make a proclamation with the ram's horn, the shofar, I'm guessing. This proclamation with the ram's horn is thus to be made on Yom Kippur. You shall sanctify the 50th year, declaring emancipation of slaves all over the world. This is your Jubilee year, when each man shall return to his hereditary property and to his family. 50th year, my guess too is maybe that's the connection, the return to the property.
Yeah.
The 50th year shall also be a Jubilee to you, insofar as you may not sow, harvest crops growing of their own accord, nor gather grapes from unpruned vines during that year. The Jubilee shall thus be holy to you. You shall eat the crops from the field that year. In the Jubilee year, every man shall return to his hereditary property. Thus, when you buy or sell land to your neighbor, do not cheat one another. You are buying only according to the number of years after the Jubilee. Therefore, he is selling to you for the number of years that the land will produce crops until the next Jubilee. Since he is selling it to you for the number of crops, you must increase the price if it will be for many years, and decrease it if there are few. You will then not be cheating one another. You shall fear your God, since it is I who am God, your Lord. Keep my decrees and safeguard my laws. If you keep them, you will live in the land securely. The land will produce its fruit, and you will eat your fill, thus living securely in the land. In the seventh year, you might ask, what will we eat in the Jubilee year? We have not planted, nor have we harvested crops. I will direct my blessing to you in the sixth year, and the land will produce enough crops for 3 years. You will therefore be eating your old crops when you plant after the eighth year. You will still be eating your old crops until the crops of the ninth year are ripe. Since the land is mine, no land shall be sold permanently. You are foreigners and resident aliens as far as I am concerned. Oh, and therefore there shall be time of redemption for all your hereditary lands.
Okay, so we have two things. We have the Shemitah, which is a cycle every seventh year. And then what is the Yovel, the Jubilee?
It's like a bonus Shemitah year.
It is a bonus, but when does it occur?
Year 50.
Year 50. So you have seven cycles of seven. So notice we have, it's seven cycles of Shabbos. There are obvious parallels. We have 6 days a week we work. 6 days, 6 years you work. Seventh day is Shabbos. Seventh year is Shemitah. Notice the 7 weeks of years. You have a Shemitah year on the 49 and the Yovel on the 50, which have the same rules. What happens in the 50th year after they blow the horn of emancipation on Yom Kippur? 10 days after the start of the 50th year. What happens on that year? What happens?
Like all the land, like all the sales of the land, like the land goes back to who originally owned it.
Exactly. Very good. Very important. So just a couple facts. In the time of the Torah, when the Jews got into the land of Israel, everybody got a portion of land. The land of Israel was divided up into tribes. The tribe was divided into families, and everybody got their land. Okay? So that was it. It was gifted to you. You didn't buy it. Now, you had your land. It was an agricultural world. You produced your crops. If you got down and out and you had to sell your land because you were what they call like you're in bad shape, what kind of sale do you engage in? Can you sell your property in perpetuity?
Or like a long-term lease.
A long-term lease. Because the land is going to go back to you on the Yovel. So let's say there's 20 years to Yovel. You're basically dividing, well, what kind of yield can this field produce? Times 20 minus the Shemitah years. Work out the deal. The Torah tells you don't cheat. If the Torah tells you not to cheat, that means there's a tremendous motivation to cheat and to use, cheating means that either price gouging or taking advantage of the person and buying it way under value. In other words, there's a pro. In fact, the law is called lo tonu. You can't financially afflict somebody either if it's a fixed price for an item, you can't charge more than 1/6 more. If you charge one more and 6 more, the sale is invalid and he can get his money back. Or conversely, let's say the guy's down and out and you buy it for 1/6 less, it's common value. Now, again, they're talking about products which are like a commodity, which have a fixed price, like a painting would not have a fixed price. It says it's a much more amorphous kind of thing. I'm not dealing with all the halakhic details, trying to give you the general motif here of how the question always is raised. Does Judaism support a capitalistic view? Does Judaism support a socialistic view? Does Judaism support a communistic view? What would you say?
It kind of seems to me like none. Like, to me, it feels like the incentive is to live on like your hereditary land. So I feel like it's more so promoting like staying in one place and like being a part of a community there, because it seems like it would be really tough to like rent land in another tribe and then like settle down there, because
that's for sure. But insofar as economic systems, what we've read, will this be supportive of a communistic, socialistic, or capitalistic?
I'd say capitalist, because like you, like they're still owners of the land who can like do with it what they please.
Right. So on one hand, there is personal ownership. You get to own whatever you own is yours. On the other hand, you're also gifted by the Torah a land. Every Jew is gets a free, in a certain sense, land for a free home.
Mm-hmm.
So that's more of a socialistic, even capital communistic point, that there's a undeniable, there are basic rights. You can't have an homeless Jew in the time of the Torah. I mean, now again, he could sell it. Let's say a person's got a psychological problem and he has to sell a thing, and then he gambles away his money. It could work out, but you see that there's a safety net. One of the safety net, of course, is Shemitah. Because during the Shemitah year, you basically you're eating everybody's fields. You go to this guy's field for the apples. You got this the person for the bananas. This person for the oranges. This person for the tomatoes. Nothing. So that's very socialisty / communist kind of vibe. On the other hand, it's yours. Your sale is a sale. Now, let me ask another question. What happens naturally in a market economy, insofar as real estate?
Some land becomes more valuable and other land becomes less valuable.
That is true. And what about as far as ownership? What happens to ownership in as far as real estate, I think nationally?
Like in the U.S.?
Yeah, in the U.S. or actually in any country. Let's say in the U.S.
Oh, like wealthier people generally own more land.
So there you go. In other words, it's literally a law of nature that there's going to be what they call, back to 2016, the one percenters. That who are going to, by nature, able to buy up, you can have a REIT, which is a trust with real estate. They buy up, like they'll buy up 100,000 houses, and then they have control of the house, and they can jack up the rent. They can do, and then since they have the economic muscle, they can really squeeze people. Now, so here, what's gonna real estate really have that level of a real estate company or a person who's an investment home buyer have that level of control in the land of Israel, at least from the biblical vision?
I guess like it feels pretty tough though, because like two people could like have different opinions on what a fair rate is. Like if I think I could like really make a lot of money off this land, I'd be willing to overpay. And like the owner might think I'm overpaying, but like from my perspective, I feel like no, it really is worth this much. So,
but let's say you bought a field with a house on it. What's going to happen on the seventh year? You can't use it. I mean, you can live in the house, and then what's going to happen on the Yovel? It's going to go back to the original guy. So that does not help. Real estate's about buying, holding, leveraging. That's it. This kills that cold market. Now there are houses you could buy up houses in a city, which doesn't have that kind of same dynamic. Now, does the Torah allow for someone to be a mega wealthy person in non-real estate assets?
Yeah.
Yes. Let's say he's a merchant and he has a series of stores. No problem. But apparently, insofar as the housing, basic land to be able to have a field to support yourself and your family and a basic house was viewed as a basic right that was gifted to every Jew. And even if he and why do you have to have a yovel? Because the nature of the wealthy are going to it's a law of nature. They're going to buy the stuff up because there are going to be people who money and them cannot stay together. There are certain people you'll meet. Them and money just seem just to come together. And there are certain people that money and them just cannot get together. They just not making they're not making the buck. They and the money making does not seem to go together. And there are some people that just like are just unbelievably gifted. And that's the way Hashem will create the world. So therefore, there's called the Yovel Shmit reset button. Boop. That's it. We're gonna, you know, it's like musical chairs. And now everybody gets a chair again. Okay. And then it's going to restart, you know? So that's the deal. So,
like, also, isn't there, like, just, like, more, some land is more valuable than other land? Like, it's not necessarily just, like, right, like, so there's always going to be some land is more valuable. So that's, like, you know, why you have to have, go back to a reset, because, like, otherwise, like, it feels like that's, like, the...
So when they distributed the land, they distributed on an equation of both quantity and quality. So if you had a very fertile land, you were given less. Person had a more arid land was giving more land to make up for the fact that it was less valuable. That was in the initial distribution. When Joshua came in, there was a whole, it was 7 years of distribution. This was not a simple thing. You know, you can see people a little bit touchy about that issue. And some complaints. So,
how did it work with cities like I mean, I know Jerusalem wasn't like anointed back then, but like.
So that's a good question. Like, I mean, cities develop, but like, did one guy have was blessed to have a city on his land? That's a good question. I don't know. I don't know how that worked out. There were cities that were sort of like in the Torah. Dedicated cities, which would be Levite cities for the Levium because they don't have land. There are 48 cities worked out. But let's say you want to start your own city. You're gonna do your own. What's the deal with that? So that's a very good question. I don't know. It's a good question. So what are some of the benefits that every ordinary Jew would get from the Shemitah? Let's just go through that. But what are the benefits?
I mean, the people who need food get food.
Okay, people get food. Okay, one benefit, people get all the food is available as it grows. Okay, number one. What else?
It's like free land to live on. Versus like today's issue, like it's very expensive to like buy land in a lot of Jewish communities.
Right. So, well, I mean, again, people would have their ancestral land, assuming that they didn't get knocked off it by having to sell it. That was you that you sold your land at the point of last option, obviously, because that's also a source of your food and your income, unless you were a merchant, which most people were agriculture. Also, there's a year off to not having to slave on your property, on your land. So you had what they call a sabbatical. You had a time off. The goal being that you may be able to dedicate yourself in, same thing for professor, in learning, growing as a Jew. It was a tremendous thing. You also, there's a thing called the Shemitah Kesafim. If you had a loan, the Shemitah would cancel it. So if you had gotten yourself into some debt, you borrowed money, it would cancel it. Again, these are various safety nets to help people who were struggling to have a second chance. Yovel, the person who sold himself into slavery, into perpetuity, which is not, for whatever reason, he was so that he gets released because he's not supposed to be a slave of a person. We're supposed to be slaves of Hashem only. So he gets released. There are a lot of basic points. Question, that's very nice. It's sort of talking about there's a Shemitah now happening now in Israel. We live in America. I want to end the class. What are some of the benefits for us right now? Sort of like, let's call it not the immediate Shemitah Yovel, but sort of the meta messages. So this is in honor of Scott. I always do some scenarios to work it through. So let's go to some scenarios. All right. Miriam MGR is considering who to invite for Shavuos lunch. What would the lesson of Shemitah attitude to the land providing food for all inform our decision? Who should she consider on the invite list? Let's start off like this. Who do people normally? Let's start with this. Who do people normally invite for a Shabbos or a Yom Tov lunch?
Friends and family.
Friends and family, correct. And there's nothing wrong with that. What would the Shemitah, you know, which sort of a kind of tzedakah, inform?
Someone that you may think that they don't have a meal or can't have a meal themselves.
Right. Somebody who either A, you know, first of all, certainly is financially not in a weak position, A, or B, there's other things also is that they may be lonely. You know, it's not just an issue of poverty, but they might be alone. In fact, there's a special mitzvah to invite on Yom Tov for everybody to participate in the national joy of the Yom Tov, people who would not have a Yom Tov meal with other people. So to invite, let's say it's a convert who may not have a lot of family, or maybe a divorcee who doesn't have a lot of family, or a widow who may be struggling. Or somebody who's, you know, whatever, you know, is just, you know, is lonely, is, you know, in MG, we have a lot of singles, you know, so all the singles get together, but not everybody, not all singles all get together. So to invite a single to help them out. So that's where the Shemitah thing, by the fact that everybody's land becomes ownerless and is now everybody free to do that, is basically about providing, you know, there's a time to provide for everybody, and Yom Tov is a good time to do it. All right, next. Bill MG receives an email from his shul rabbi. They need to expand the amount of hosts who do Shabbos and Yom Tov hospitality for the community. How would the message of Shemitah and its expansion of this communal safety net inform his decision? Let me explain. In every organized synagogue, you'll have what they call a Hachnasa Orchim committee. What does that mean? People are coming to the, people are on business and they got to be in the community for Shabbos and Yom Tov, or they have, for whatever reason, they're there with a sick relative. They're coming in for a simcha. It could be five different reasons they need to be put up for the Shabbos and Yom Tov, right? So what organized Jewish communities have is they'll have a hospitality committee where basically they'll, you know, the rabbis say, oh, email Barbara. She's the chair of the hospitality community. You'll email Barbara and say, I'm coming for Shavuos. I visit my aunt. She's not doing well, blah, blah. Don't worry. And meanwhile, Barbara will set the guy up for all the meals within all the committee. So how would the message of Shemitah and its expansion of the communal safety net, and we talk about canceling loans, everybody can eat up any of the fields. What is it? How would the Shemitah frame of mind inform Bill what to do about the need to expand the amount of hosts to do Shabbos and Yom Tov hospitality?
He should join the committee or like volunteer to host.
You volunteer to host. Doesn't mean you have to host all the people for all the time, but be another name. And, you know, it's like, and you say like, yeah, so I could, you know, I could do a meal. I could do the second Yom Tov lunch, right? Okay, that's a win. All right, lastly, Ashley MGR cannot have any guests this Yom Tov because of the work being done on her home. What options does she have to apply the message of Shemitah? What options does she have? She can't host anybody.
I mean, she's got, you know, a good excuse.
The answer is she's got a great excuse and she's got a get out of jail free card, and that's it. So that's that. Okay. So but there's another option is that every community, listen, in New York, there's like, for example, there's Onik Shabbos of the Upper West Side, where they actually provide food on all the Shabbos and Yom Tov to people who are in food crisis. There are 100 families in the Upper West Side, and they give them like debit cards to Kosher Marketplace, and they can get them. And therefore, and before Yom Tov, we did a we participated in a fundraiser for their Purim drive. They raised like $6,000-$7,000. Every family got $500 for Matan Sev Yonim. They raised like $40,000 for Pesach, $50,000 for Pesach. We participated in that. So therefore, people, you know, it's not the same as being invited over to Ashley. Ashley's great to be with, but at least that they're going to have, at the very least, they're going to have, you know, not have to eat a tuna fish sandwich for Yontif. They'll have a high quality Yontif celebratory meal. So if you can't do it, you know, there's in other communities they have what they call a Tomchei Shabbos, where foods are delivered to the people's doors. Just you should know, all rabbis have a rabbi discretionary fund where people who are having a crisis will get financial help from the rabbi. So to give money to the rabbi's fund, Rabbi Levine at the Jewish Center, every rabbi has that, and they take care of people in the community and beyond. And that's way to inhabit to the, honestly, I'm not a landowner in Israel right now, but the message of Shemitah, so the meta message of Shemitah is still pertinent to us. And that's basically I wanted to sort of connect us to the Parsha, Shemitah, and Yovel, sort of give us a sense of that in a certain sense, is Judaism like capitalism, socialism, communism? It's sort of like a little bit of all of the above. It believes in ownership. It believes that you have to, you know, take an active role in your personal destiny, like a capitalist. On the other hand, there are safety nets, like a socialism, even a little bit of communism, which is there to help out people. We have the Shemitah, food for all. We have tzedakah, obviously. We have not cutting the corners. We have giving trumas and maizos to the Kohen Levi. Releasing of the debts on releasing of loans, canceling the loans in the Shemitah. You got the Yovel, you got the returning of the ancestral home. So people got bought out. They can get another chance. All these different things are safety nets to help out people who are intrinsically disadvantaged. And, you know, we take care of the Ani and the Evyon, the poor and the destitute. And that's a major part about being a good Jew. Any questions?
Only question, Rabbi, are you willing to get Ari Bergman to come speak about Shemitah, what he's doing in Eretz Yisrael right now? He's doing something crazy for the coming year.
Well, Shemitah's this year.
I'm saying this year. So he has like a whole thing. They raised millions of dollars to support the farmers and to have the fruit not go to waste so that all the boys are eating. I couldn't keep up with him, but he would break it down nicely for it'd be great
that's
as a follow-up.
Pretty awesome. So obviously we'll want to get him, you know, Ari Bergman. Ari Bergman is very close to Ray Wilds. So he's spoken at the MG a number of times, but that's a cool
guest speaker.
Yeah. Maybe give him a skull in residence to move it up a couple of notches.
I have the Rambam or somebody else, but there's a whole thing. Not only like the Shemitah shouldn't just be left on the field, but that it should be eaten or something.
Oh, correct. Right. So what, just explain to everybody else. Now that is what you just mentioned, Chaim, is literally an entire shiur in its own right of, how is Shemitah observed in Israel in 2022 or 5782? That's a class in its own right. So we'll have to leave that for another time. But that's a great idea. All right, guys. I want to wish you a great night. Thanks for I apologize for the delay, but thanks for sticking with it, and we had a great time. All the best.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. Bye-bye.